Mr. Cook, I'm honored to have this opportunity to interview you this afternoon, and perhaps if you could start by giving us the name so that it's on the recording, and telling us how you came to work in some connection with the grain industry.
Oh, that's a pretty long story.
Well, you want to give us your name first and then tell the story. I'm interested in hearing it.
My name is Victor Barry Cook. I'm a mechanical engineer graduate from the University of Toronto.
And so you grew up in Thunder Bay, or
I grew up in Thunder Bay.
Or what was then Port Arthur.
Yes.
And did your family have any connection with the grain industry here in the city?
Oh, very much so. My father ended up being president of Barnum McQueen Company.
Which was a construction company, was it?
It was. Barnum McQueen probably designed more elevators in Thunder Bay and built them than anyone else.
Right. And so Barnett McQueen then was an engineering and design company.
Engineering and design and construction.
And construction
company
as well.
Yes.
To take them all on. Do you remember what some of the biggest projects would have been that Barnett McQueen carried out?
As a construction company, and it's a matter of history, which you're interested in.
Indeed.
They built Pool 7 for SAS Pool 7, of course. And this was an exceptional undertaking. They had all the services and what have you necessary to build it. So they started driving piles, I believe it was in March. I can look it up here somewhere. And they were receiving grain in active duty 10 months later.
Wow.
So it was a really well-run operation in that case.
And that much company, quite clearly. And so your father was an engineer himself?
Father was an accountant.
Ah, well, that's a good man to have as a president. And yeah. So you were sent off to the University of Toronto to get an engineering?
No. I wasn't. My father was overseas in the Second World War, and I said to my mother, I want to join the army. I was 16 or something at the time. And she said, well, you can't join the army until you finish high school. So as soon as I was finished high school, I joined the army. And they looked at me and they said they were looking for people like me. I was 17 at the time.
1943.
43. Yes. And they put me in a particularly group of young people that were joining the army about the same time, that had their senior matriculation and what have you. And they put us in as future potential officers.
Of course.
And during that time, we got the usual army training. And during the first year, we went to Toronto University for 8 months and took a very intensive engineering course.
I see. It was already oriented to mechanical engineering then? Or was it just a broad engineering program?
It was a broad engineering program. But engineering is engineering, you know.
I'll take your word for it. Having an electrical in the family, I won't press it on him. And
give you an idea, I have a daughter who's an engineer. I have a granddaughter that I just went to Vancouver to put an iron ring on her finger. So she's an engineer. I have another daughter that's an electrical engineer. We have a slew, and I have a grandson that's an engineer. It proliferates, and I didn't force them into this. They must have got it over the breakfast table. As a matter of fact, I can remember my daughter, who was an engineer, a mechanical engineer, incidentally, and had applied to McGill to take something or other advanced. And she said, you know, Dad, I have no, one of the upper levels. I have no real compunction of taking this course. I said, well, you know, daughter, I got news for you. If you don't feel like taking it, don't. That's my one advice. You got to be interested in what you're taking.
Absolutely.
And so she said, well, I remember one time when I was about 13, we were having breakfast. And I said to you, Dad, would you ever hire a female engineer? And your answer was, no damn way. So I said, you know, times have changed. I would today.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, if you look at the old company, there must be 30 of them, female engineers, yeah, on the staff.
Times did indeed change. My brother,
oh, yes.
My brother was with Manitoba Hydro, and he had the task at one point, it seems to me it may have been into the 80s, of doing some expediting in terms of ensuring that they would have electrical engineer, women electrical engineers. I think he was proudest, I think, of one who was of an Iranian background who was coming into the company in terms of diversifying Manitoba Hydro's employees. Did your brothers pursue engineering as well?
No, not at all.
No.
My oldest brother, who's passed away now, took a degree in commerce and finance. And my middle brother, he became an architect, and a very successful architect.
Practicing here in the city, or?
No, in Calgary.
In Calgary?
Yes.
Okay. Lots of building boom there.
Yeah.
So you had the 1 year, and did you serve for a time? Were you in the Army as an officer then?
I wasn't ever an officer. I was a private when I joined, and I was a private when I was discharged.
But their anticipations made you an engineer.
Well, when the bomb went off and there was no point in staying in the Army at any time, or I didn't think so, I applied to university, and they gave me leave to go to Toronto University, and if I got in, I'd get my discharge. Well, I got in and they gave me my first year engineering on the subjects that I'd passed before.
Sure.
So.
And you completed the degree, and came back to Port Arthur then to work here?
Yes, I did. I came back and I went to work for Barnett McQueen Company.
How long did Barnett McQueen continue?
Oh, it went broke about 10 years ago, I guess.
Okay. You weren't with it at that point?
No, I wasn't.
You'd established your own firm?
I had just established my own.
Had you seen the handwriting on the wall in regards to Barnett McQueen? Or?
Something like that.
Right. And so V.B. Cook and Company was what it then became?
V.B. Cook Company Limited.
Company, yes. Right. Was there any connection to C.D. Howe's company? Or was that all quite separate?
Oh, that was quite with a great deal of animosity.
Between Barnett McQueen and Howe?
Yes.
Competition?
Competition, yes.
Right. Although animosity suggests.
And I knew Mr. Howe, and we got along very well.
Yeah. Well, he was your member of Parliament until 1957, wasn't
yes.
he? So, and you've been back working for about 10 years, I would guess, by then.
Yes.
Came back about 1948.
I graduated in 1948.
48. And so, at what point did your own work, was there any elevator construction taking place?
No, not at all.
Nothing at all?
A little bit of repair work and this, right, that, and the other thing.
Right.
And Cyril Green Company.
Yes, the president of the company.
No, that he was the manager.
The manager here.
Thunder Bay, Les Irwin.
Right.
And Les Irwin was, at that time and during that period, we had the explosions in the grain trade.
Well, there was a mighty one in August of 1945, wasn't there?
Yes, there was.
Still in the Army.
Yeah.
Right. And you mentioned those in terms of challenges that were faced by the companies that owned the elevators, I suppose.
Yes, and I mentioned Les Irwin because I can't imagine him ever having an explosion in a grain facility that he was running.
Say a little bit more about that.
Because he believed in cleanliness being next to godliness. And he would fire a person rather than have it in it.
Right.
And in some of these elevators at that time, you walked in dust up to your ankles. It was that bad.
Was it that great a challenge to keep them clean?
We didn't have any grain cleaning equipment at that time. They came after that. But the challenge is all in the eye of the beholder. It costs money to keep a house clean. And most of the operators were very sure they didn't want to spend any excess money.
Just too tight-fisted.
Yes.
But the Searle Company and Mr. Irwin disagreed.
Oh, Les Irwin was terribly afraid of dust explosions. He'd seen a couple in his young years.
Okay.
And there certainly...
If your office as a superintendent was in the elevator building, particularly, you'd want to be very sure it was clean.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose the superintendents mostly had their offices in those terminal elevators.
This is a paper I wrote on dust.
You just had it over a binder with the a paper inside, The Dust Problem in Grain Elevators by B.B. Cook. Submitted in partial fulfillment of the requirements for the degree of Bachelor of Applied Science at the University of Toronto, October 31st, 1947. Halloween Day, appropriately enough, if something went wrong. So this is based on research that you carried out primarily in the literature. I see the first two of the three persons that you acknowledge receiving help from were both with you, commented on the cost of keeping elevators clean. I was tempted to refer to the West Virginia mine disaster that's just being dealt with these days.
They have a
April of...
They have a terrible record.
2010, and obviously the company has all kinds of infractions in 2009, and they clearly let the... And now I hope the company has to pay for all the work that's being done to try to rescue these men, because that's surely when one learns how short-sighted it is to pinch pennies. Well, this was actually it is headed a thesis, isn't it?
Well, it's a sort of a thesis.
Yes. Certainly a major paper, without doubt. Well, I won't read it into the record or anything of that sort, but that,
Anything I give you here, you're welcome to it in its entirety or what have you.
I think a copy of this, however we obtain it, to buy a photocopy on your part or whatever, this would be a useful addition. I'd actually find it very interesting to read this because it's a little here, and then as you have observed, there were others later on. Did this thesis point to the importance of dust control and explosion prevention? I was reading the heading on page 26. Was your company involved at all in developing the equipment or installing it? Did you do anything in the way of...
Eventually, we did install some dust equipment. But don't forget when I said there was a certain amount of enmity between C.D. Howe Company and us. He had all the advantage, of course.
Can you expand on that? We can't interview him. He's gone. So you'll have to tell him from your side of the table.
Well, politically, yes, he was a powerhouse, of course.
Been member of Parliament from 1935 to 1957, and he was minister for practically all of that
minister
time.
Minister of everything.
Yes, during the war, minister of, I think he was the first minister of, was it transport in the 35 government? He was straightened colors later on.
Don't get me wrong. He was very good to us.
But the rivalry was fierce.
Of course, as you can understand.
Yeah. Did the companies in town, the terminal elevator owners, Sask Poole, for example, did they respond to this in terms of the political power of the firm out of which the minister had come? Did C.D. Howe and company end up with real advantages in the bidding?
Very real advantages.
And so you were forced. What could you bring to the competition? A sharp pencil and...
We were Searle's consulting engineer on anything they wanted mm-hmm. for years and years, and C.D. Howe never got a sniff in at that.
Whereas I suppose Saskatchewan Pool Elevators...
Saskatchewan, all the pools and what have you went to...
A number of other smaller companies, independent companies... I guess they were independent elevator companies in town. So those were the other ones you'd be looking to for work then.
Other elevators in town. What elevators are you referring to?
Well, I don't have the list handy with me. I was beginning to put one together using directories in particular from earlier years. But, well, you could answer the question. The rhetorical question you're suggesting is that... You're suggesting that by the 1950s, there wasn't very much other than the big pool elevator companies and Searle. Was there no other company left by that time? But they all...
They virtually all disappeared.
Through the war years then, because they were there in the 20s and 30s, but...
In the 20s and 30s, you had companies like Reliance. And, mm-hmm. There was a host of companies along the waterfront. That changed.
Had they all been taken over?
Speaking, the majority had been taken over. How they were taken over, or what the mechanics were, I have no idea.
No. But they got the advantage. Well, I guess the next question is, when did you start working in the grain industry, or in your case it would be when perhaps you had the first contract from Searle, and what sort of thing did it involve?
Well, as you remember, United Grain Growers had one annex fall in the water. And this became very important to the grain industry because they were all virtually built the same way.
Yeah, there's nothing like that kind of disaster to focus the mind. So why had it fallen over?
Yeah, well, the as you just met. A grain elevator is a tall building, basically, and it's got piling under it. And this is native spruce piling. And I'm not criticizing that, because when we got into United Grain Growers to dig out all the mess and what have you, we jet the old piling out, and they'd come up and float on the water. And yet they'd been installed and covered with water for 50 years or so.
So the wood was quite satisfactory?
Oh, the wood was entirely satisfactory. Many of the old wood went to the Abitibi mill to be made paper. Mm-hmm. You know, there was nothing wrong, and we've advocated this ever since, that as long as it's covered in water, you don't need to worry about it.
Right, as long as it's in water, but a wooden ship. But you take it out into the air and try to lock it inside it.
But most of the elevators had one thing. They filled this with fill.
That's an area beside the elevator. The piles are underneath it. Moving over a little distance over, there's a great quantity of fill, and of dirt. Is this dirt that came out of the area under the elevator, or why was
it? Wherever it came out of. As long as it would fill to hold up the railway tracks.
Okay.
That was all that concerned them at that time.
Right. And there were piles under that as well.
And there were piles under that in places, but not entirely.
And now that would all be dry, I suppose. The timber there, or as dry as soil will allow it to be.
Well, the lower echelon was not dry. It was just as waterlogged as this city to stay in one place and what have you. And eventually, for whatever reason, this area let go. And the elevator went over.
So it was a sort of soil migration from under the railway track embankment into the where the annex had been, where UGG that destroyed the stability of the soil under it.
That's a very simple way of putting it.
Right. Well, I'm a simple historian. but this was something that you discovered in the process of cleaning the area.
Well, there were all kinds of investigations went on from very excellent engineering firms and what have you. And through their soils engineering, we learned a lot about what earth would stand.
Of course, was that the railway tracks embankment are on the one side, but it's water. And the area
you've got a slip running down.
Right.
There.
Now, had the soil actually been sliding into the slip area, and should it have been noticed that the ground?
I can't really comment on that. I wasn't involved when it happened. Yes. We were involved in pulling the muck out.
Right.
So, but the soil lost its strength after so many years of a constant force. Now, when you have a couple of railway tracks and full cars going by, that's enough to...
The vibration of it.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, I can imagine it would be... So just, of course, it could begin to... Maybe reaches a breaking point and suddenly just breaks out.
As suddenly it broke out, yes. Yeah.
Was the annex salvageable? It couldn't be saved as was.
No.
It had all to be taken apart and removed, I suppose. There was a case of an elevator tipping over near Portship years earlier, I guess, was it?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know anything about
Ogilvie's.
Ogilvie's?
Yeah.
Or in the camp? Yeah. I thought there was one near Portship as well that tipped over. Or is that...
When you use the word Portship, what do you mean?
Port Arthur Shipyard, the dry dock.
The only one near the dry dock was United Greengrocers.
Okay, and it never did, eh? But over in Ogilvie, near the mouth of the Cam, fell
over. Yeah, it fell into the river.
I suppose it would be a similar kind of problem,
I don't really know.
The soil.
That happened long before my time.
Yeah.
I wasn't born then.
So you ended up having the salvage contract here in terms of cleaning up the area.
We got the salvage contract and restoring the foundation. We had to jet out all the original piles and put in new piles and what have you. We didn't get the contract to build the new annex.
Darn. Hmm? Who did it go to?
I don't know who built it, as a matter of fact.
But your contract involved cleaning it out and building it up to annex, or was someone else then given the task of restoring the foundation?
We were given the task of providing a new foundation for the new annex.
To ground level or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Or to water level.
Water level.
Digging out all the old grain and muck and what have you that was there, and get there before the moose got it all.
I suppose the stuff ferments as well, and what it
stunk to hell.
I can well imagine.
I can remember coming home at night and my wife saying, "Get your clothes off, you stink."
Yeah, how large a crew did you have at work on it?
Oh, I don't know, 30 people, I guess.
You would have hired people as well, mm-hmm. I suppose. So a lot of this was just good old mucking work, I suppose.
Oh, yes.
It didn't require a degree.
Labor work.
Yeah. Yes. How large was your firm through these years? It varied, I suppose, but... Now, this would be... It's Barnett McQueen, because I'm thinking of your later company, of course, it's Barnett
McQueen. It was Barnett McQueen that got
the contract, of course, carried that out.
So I find it difficult to tell you how many
men
they had employed.
Was that company established here at the Lakehead? Were there the principals, I suppose, Messrs. Barnett and McQueen, were they Thunder Bay people, do you know?
No, they weren't.
Sidney Howe, of course, was not either, having come via Halifax. And he taught at Dalhousie briefly before getting into this work, having come out of the New England, out of Massachusetts, I guess.
There's another book. I'm good at having books. That tells you the history of V.V. Cook Company, and of course tells you the origins of Barnett McQueen, if you're interested.
Well, we might take a copy of that as well later on.
Yeah.
So you had the contract at UGG cleaning this up. What were the next opportunities that...
The next opportunity was to take a look at the Searle Grain Company. They wanted a 30-foot slip.
30-foot depth.
30-foot depth from water surface.
Right.
To do that without some serious consideration after the fall of the elevator into the creek was a serious consideration. Yeah. Anyway, they thought we were capable, so We did the drawings and calculations and what have you to provide a safe structure and the existing structure for them to have.
How much further down were you having to go? What was the slip already at that point?
28 feet.
Oh, so it was just at another 2 feet?
Yeah.
But
that could be very critical.
Yes. What would usually be have been established? How would the foundation of an elevator have been separated from the slip as a rule? I suppose, would concrete have been poured? Or what would the edge of a slip be next to the elevator?
The edge of a slip would be usually steel piling.
I see. Driven down
some 20 feet below the 30 feet, if you will.
Right, so you'd be down to 50 feet. If you're 50 feet down along the waterfront, you're running into something solid down there, are you?
No.
And you're still sort of...
But you got to take all the forces and their
yes.
term and what have you.
I don't have any pile experience at all, but I was on the committee at St. Paul's United when St. Paul's Place was under planning and then, of course, was constructed. And I remember the architect coming along one day to tell us that we needed to do more in the way of putting piling under that building because there's something like shale some distance down on a kind of a hillside. And
yeah, that could be.
And he talked about understanding this in terms of, say, an arrangement of toothpicks driven into the ground. And I said, so John Stevenson, I said, John, toothpicks don't give me a lot of confidence in the piling. I'd like to hear about something a bit stronger than that. So that's what has me wondering. There, I think, at whatever, I don't remember the height of the piling or the depth they were running into this.
But the piling would be not like is under the elevators because it wouldn't be covered in water all the time.
No, and the ground, I suppose, probably provides some stability too. It's drier as well, but there. So the getting those piles down would be a nice piece of work too, pile driving. You can tell us about that fine process, I suppose.
Yes, we ended up using, as you see along the waterfront now, you see cranes with a silly looking thing hanging down from them when they're driving pile. What they're holding up in the air is a diesel pile driver. In other words, it's got all the elements of a pile driver and it's all enclosed and they pull back the piston and drop it, and it fires and provides enough force to put down the pile a few inches.
I sense just a touch of contempt here in your description of
this. We had a diesel pile driver.
Oh, I see. So it was basically the same
Oh, yes, very much so.
And so how many blows a minute? Or is it per hour?
Oh, it'd be per hour. You'd get, I've forgotten now, I haven't been around a pile driver for some time. But you'd get five blows per minute, perhaps, if it was a well looked after system.
Running efficiently. And five blows might sink a pile by?
A foot, maybe.
A foot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 20 feet below the bottom of the slip. I guess how many piles would be required to, and what would be the proportion? How many per 10 feet or?
I can't remember now. And you don't figure it that way anyway.
No, I suspected I didn't. Or you didn't.
But, we got the piles in without any difficulty, and then there's fill to go in around the piles where they're sticking out of the water, if you will. So you
No, you want all of that well protected because the hull of a ship is going to be in the area shortly. Dropping the bottom or increasing the depth of the slip by 2 feet was going to be worth doing in terms of the ships that Searle was going to be filling. Now, was this...
Oh, well, it applied to Searle and it applied to UGG, too.
And I suppose all the others. Would this be as a result of the St. Lawrence Seaway completion and bigger ships, deeper ships coming in?
I really can't tell you now. No. Can't remember.
Remember roughly when this was that you were doing the work?
I'd have to look it up.
Yeah, if it were late 50s, it would fit right in because the...
be the late 50s.
Yeah, the St. Lawrence Seaway was opened by Queen Elizabeth and President Eisenhower about 1958, I think. I'd have to check to be certain, but it's about that time.
Anyway, it was finished off.
Right.
And the Cereal Grain Company hasn't shown any sign of movement whatsoever.
Yes. And that's a great satisfaction to you.
That's a great satisfaction to us.
You don't drive down every day just to check to be sure it's still horizontal, or vertical rather.
No.
Did you have other contracts with grain companies after that, or in any kind of connection? Did Barnett McQueen have more?
If they were, they were very modest.
Mm-hmm. Because there was, in fact, so little taking place in the way of construction.
That's right.
Were you, or was the company involved at all with the dust control activity, the pollution control equipment that came in through the 70s and 80s, I guess?
Yes, we put a lot of it in.
Now this is both the predecessor company and then your own, I suppose, was it?
Yes.
Yes.
Depending on whether we did the engineering or whether somebody else did the engineering, we were contractors.
So you did some of the installation, the actual building,
yes,
as well. What can you tell us about this whole matter of taking elevators in hand to reduce the dust that was floating around? The background, first of all, did that involve you at all? Who made the decision? What kind of pressure was there on companies to do this?
That's a terrible question to ask. I don't know.
Right.
I suggest it was there was an awful lot of pressure on the companies to do this from the point of view of getting control of their problem, mm-hmm, but only for a certain price.
Something we must look into. I wonder whether governments were involved, whether regulations were tightened up and so on. One would think that that would be a logical thing, whether the union was involved in pressing for safer conditions and so on. But in any case, as far as you're concerned, the work then was going to be undertaken. Did any company lead, or were they all seemingly involved with it when it got going?
They were all seemingly involved with it when it got going.
Whether they...
And they're very similar.
So the equipment itself was similar. Was there
mm-hmm,
was there one company wherever supplying this equipment, or to what extent with this was the machinery that would actually, I presume, pull the dust out? Is the vacuum cleaner principle the one that is being used?
It's the vacuum cleaner principle is being used, and the tanks are got like filter cloths in them that separate the dust from the...
Right. So it's in the same way that a woodworker in his shop, if he or she has any sense, will put in the vacuum cleaner arrangements to gather up the dust. The same thing is happening here in the elevators then with this.
That's correct.
Who was this, the main supplier of equipment? Do you remember? Was it a company in the States, or...
I can't remember.
No. And so were the...
I think it was more or less local.
Construction locally of the mm-hmm, the equipment then,
mm-hmm,
following the kinds of principles that would apply.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be a matter of working with the same kind of mm-hmm, principles then.
That's right.
So your design would actually involve clearly all the work in the elevator for the pipes that were required and so on and so forth.
That's
I
correct.
Suppose. And then
the unit, and the fans.
And the fans.
Yeah.
Pulling at the air. And you'd be hiring people to do the construction, or did you have the workers who would undertake that already?
There were companies that wanted the work, so.
Mm-hmm. And so you were at the...
We sent it out to tender, if you will.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And gradually, the conditions in elevators...
Greatly improved.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, tremendously improved. When I say you were walking up to your ankles in dust, I'm not kidding.
Mm-hmm.
It was terrible. Why anybody in his right mind would allow that to happen, I don't know.
Really beyond comprehension. yeah. in terms of the sheer danger of it.
Yes. But Les Irwin was one of the very few people that seemed to understand the danger of it.
Yes.
And yet these explosions were happening in the United States with some regularity. And in the East Coast, or West Coast, we had a few blow-ups too.
Mm-hmm. So there were, was the Lakehead fortunate that there were fewer of them here?
I think the Lakehead was very fortunate. We had two, didn't we?
Hmm.
Yeah, certainly at least two. Yeah.
One in 53 and one in 45.
45 and 53.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea why there was such a run of luck on the waterfront here that there were so few?
Just that who controls the money, and some of them were too stingy.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose the managers weren't people like, I gather, Les Irwin, who'd experienced it personally and resolved not to allow those conditions to develop. They simply, I suppose, if you've got an ankle deep, it's more than one season probably, or would this happen during one season?
Oh no, it wouldn't happen during one season.
So this was cumulative.
Mm-hmm.
When they shut down for the winter a slack period, they didn't bother cleaning up.
That's right. They didn't.
Whereas they could have, it just would have taken hours or days, I suppose, whenever it was.
Always a terrible job.
Well, yes. Of course, that's also the occupational health side of it. When this stuff is on the ground and you walk through it, some of it's going to billow up.
Certainly.
And you're breathing.
You're increasing the danger, too.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Well, I've got questions about this contract that you had in connection with the great elevator.
Relatively recently, we built a couple of elevators. And I've got to go over to the office and dig out the drawings and find out where and when and how and what have you with them, but I will do that.
Was this, it wasn't here at the lake yet, it was out on the prairies then, was it?
No, we V.B. Cook Company had nothing to do with out on the prairies.
Okay. So this was construction here at the Lakehead?
I'm trying to remember.
Or was it by any chance down the seaway? Because there are, of course,
elevators down there. Yes.
We were interviewing a just retired a grain inspector who began reeling off the elevators in which he had done work over the years, and it was a most impressive list. We did Old Sound, Collingwood, and Port Colborne, and so on and so forth, working our way just down the Great Lakes, and then, of course, beyond that. So you could have had contracts at various places, Montreal, Sorel, and so on and so forth.
And Quebec City.
Quebec City, yes, indeed.
As a matter of fact, we took the Quebec City elevator apart, basically, and that's owned by Bunge, if I remember.
Oh, yes. Bunge is a U.S.?
It's a U.S. company.
It's one of the very large grain
handlers. It's the second largest grain handler in the world.
After Cargill?
Cargill.
Yeah. Was this removing the elevator then when you say you took it apart?
Well, essentially, the president of Bunge in Canada contacted me and said, I'd like you to come and talk to me. I went to talk to him, and finally we got a multi-million dollar contract. To give you an idea, they would normally handle 20 to 30 million tons a year. And after we got through with less than half the crew, they handled over 70 million tons.
Wow. That's more than doubling capacity, but having the crew.
and you could walk around in the place in a blue suit and not get any spots on you.
So it'd be one of the projects that you would be very proud of in terms
of... Oh, very definitely.
The capacity improvement and so on.
And I've heard all the statements about the ethics of Quebec while running a company. These people are excellent. Mm-hmm. They've been one of our best customers.
And by these companies, these people, you mean Bungie or engineering firms down there as well? The management and the workers there were citizens of Quebec, if you will, or?
Yes.
Citizens,
yes, but they were excellent.
Yeah.
You got paid on time, you got paid the right amount on time, and what have you.
Sure.
You know, there was no fooling with the bill or anything like that.
Well, whatever may have been true of Quebec before 1960, what we historians know as the Quiet Revolution, the modernization of Quebec, development of great engineering firms and so on and so forth, made Quebec, I think, world class pretty quickly. One only needs to say Lavalin and SNC?
SNC.
As two of the great
firms. Both of them, both Lavalin and SNC, got most of their contracts from the government.
Yeah, well, and Hydro, Hydro-Québec is part of that as well. Yes, indeed, it's sort of built up that way. Are there other contracts that I'd be proud of in terms of what...
Yes, there's one down along the border. It's about a $5 million ton, excuse me, has a capacity about 5 million tons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, pretty well a nice operation.
You hesitate short of saying world class, the best in the world, is it?
I think so.
Where is it located?
I got to look that up for you. It's been 10 years now since we were doing anything. So.
A Canadian elevator, or you said
a Canadian elevator.
Right. Yeah. Sure.
As a matter of fact, they were called for tenders. Sasquatchpool has an elevator in this group, too. And the Sasquatchpool elevator guy says to me one day, I wish we'd done, because yours a lot more efficient.
Okay. So what would efficiency in an elevator require? What sorts of things did your design incorporate?
Well, you know, they take all the received grain and put it in big tanks.
Mm-hmm.
The arrangement of our tanks was such that it turned over faster.
Now, had you expected it would have that result?
Yes.
And so, what were you drawing on in that tank design?
Nothing. Pure luck.
I thought engineering brilliance might be the answer.
I could tell you that, but and I hope that's the way it goes down, but it was pure luck.
So you came up with a design. Was it your own design?
Yes, it was.
Personally, as you were the principal of the company.
Yes.
Yourself?
By that time we had about 30 employees, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Of course, some of these are various kinds of staff.
Mm-hmm.
But in the design section itself, working with you, there would only be perhaps...
Every drawing we turned out was checked. Okay. And that's where a lot of the help comes in.
I'm sure. Drafts people of various sorts and all the rest of it. When you say it was luck, it still, it takes a certain knowledge of elevators brought to bear on developing that design.
Yes, it does.
Had you visited elevators in many places?
I've visited a great many elevators in many places, yes.
And you probably noticed differences in the way in which they were set up.
Not particularly.
No.
We're not stupid in Canada, or not more stupid than the other people.
So the elevators were...
There wasn't that much difference amongst them.
But when you got finished with yours, it was better than what Saskatoon was operating, I gather. Yeah.
And if you wanted to see some of these examples, I can arrange that.
At your, because the company continues, doesn't it?
The grain company continues.
Well, I was thinking also V.D. Cook is still.
Oh, yeah. They have 120 or 130 people working there. Right.
Do you have any connection with it now?
No.
You've sold out completely to others, or they're paying you, or whichever, those are your arrangements, obviously.
I got very little out of it.
Who is the principal now?
One of the Knutson family. Dave Knutson is the principal.
Okay. Yeah. So when you mentioned the plans, it would be a matter of visiting the elevator in question.
We have the plans in the vehicle coming. If you'd like to see the plans, you're welcome to see them.
Well, I think it would be, you could give me a tour, and whether you're interested in Owen and coming along as well, you could give us a tour sometime, or at least visit some part of V.D. Cook, could we?
All right.
That sounds like an interesting thing to do.
I think you should see the plans first and then see the elevator as it exists.
Yeah, yes, well, that would make sense. I suppose you would actually have quite a collection of plans of various elevators and related works.
Mm-hmm.
When the inland terminal activity began on the prairies, which was sometime in the 80s, I guess.
No.
Or was it?
Oh, it was earlier.
Well, there are the government-owned inland terminals, all right, yes, which would take us back to almost before your birth, I think, actually.
No.
Well, what were you going to say? Can you tell us about
in the West? I used to have the names down by.
Oh, shut up. Okay, well, with that little interruption on the telephone, we were just talking about the big elevators, the turbo elevators on the prairies, and you were suggesting there were three. There's one near Saskatoon.
Yes.
And there's one, I think, is it in the Lethbridge area?
There's one in Lethbridge, one in Saskatoon.
And the third one?
There's another one.
But it's not in Manitoba, I don't think. Would it be Southern Prairie, Saskatchewan Prairie? In any case, these were built by the Canadian government, I guess.
They were contracted for by the Canadian government. Barnum McQueen designed and built the three of them.
I see. Okay, I can understand.
And that's where C.D. Howe comes into the picture. He was a general, as it were. And after that, he formed his own firm and was competition.
I see. And when he was appointed to this, was he still an engineering professor at Dalhousie? Which
I don't know.
Which I believe he was before. I must go back and do some biography, at least one biography of him, which probably answers that question, how these things happen. But the Barnett McQueen records, prints and all the rest of it, did those pass to you? Or?
Yes, they passed. What were left of them passed to us.
I see. So there's you have quite a stock of information, that, including conceivably the plans for these inland terminals?
I can't answer the question.
Right. They wouldn't have to go into the drawers to find out what's there. But it'll be very interesting for us to be able to look. I will much appreciate the opportunity to read that history and get a sense of this, the function, the engineering and designing and so on for elevators. You didn't have anything to do with that later phase when Cargill put up a terminal at Elm Creek, close to where I grew up, actually. I think it was the first. Elm Creek in Manitoba. There's one there that I think is Cargill. And then, of course, gradually, I think Cargill's having started the activity, set the pace, if you will. Others, Patterson's.
All the modern little elevators there are now.
Yes, and And in fact, the whole prairie seat has been transformed. The little line elevators are practically, many of them are gone completely. They've been displaced by these. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we were other involvements with the grain trade that you were involved with through the years?
I can tell you a few funny instances.
We'd love to hear them.
With Lesser, when we were trying to figure out a sort of a pressure cooker for oats for some Central American or for some Arab organization to feed his racehorses. That's about all I know about it. I had a great to do with the pressure cooker, but what happened eventually.
You did design it.
Yes.
Yes. And so, wherever, I guess well-cooked oats would be better for the horses, would it?
I guess so. Easier to digest or something.
We know that it's fed Scots for a century, so it must be good for horses too. Better watch myself here, depending by ethnic origins or others than Scotland, then I get away with it. So that was one of your experiences. Mm-hmm. Other experiences with the grain trade?
Not particularly. Once you get out until the more modern ones came, when we built at least one full-size grain elevator. And I'll have to look up the place and time. And
I suppose there was a real satisfaction in being able to do something like that.
Oh, certainly there was.
When for years there hadn't been any building at all, really.
No.
Quite aside from the grain trade work, your engineering firm, maybe Barnett McQueen before that, did other kinds of work as well, I suppose.
I think B.B. Cook Company worked for the mining industry a great deal.
Mining paid you bread and butter, I suppose, as they say.
Well, did more than that.
Thank God.
We built some of the largest hoisting capacity head frames. In fact, until recently, we were building three of them across Canada. Do you know what a head frame is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And these wouldn't fit your standards because our head frames are the size and type we're building is an oblong thing in cross section.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be 200 feet high.
The head frame arrangement.
The head frame arrangement. This tower can be 200
feet. You shouldn't see the arrangement. The head frame itself could tower up 200 feet.
Yeah.
And
it would have a hoist in it that would boggle your imagination. Like, say, 10,000 horsepower. That's a big electric drive.
And these were electric, electrically powered.
Oh yes.
And the shafts, that's not really a question of how large or how deep the shaft is. It's a question of what you want to lift on.
Most of these shafts would be 3,000 feet or more.
Okay. Right.
And the shaft, the hole in the ground, which is called the shaft, would be concrete lined all the way down.
I've studied the gold mining industry around Lake of the Woods 100 years ago, and I've seen profiles of the 110 years ago or so of these mines. They would go down a few hundred feet. There were the drifts off at various levels, but concrete line to 3,000 feet, that's a more recent phenomenon.
Well, these were all for potash.
Ah, the big mines in Saskatchewan, then.
Well, we got one in New Brunswick, That's for Potash Company of America. And one in Esterhazy.
Southern Saskatchewan, southeastern.
And where's the other one? I've forgotten where the other one is.
Never been underground in a, well, I've never been underground in any mine. I guess, well, that's one of my things on my bucket list. I guess that's a lot of that movie, the old guys who had things still to do. But potash mine particularly, I'm a farmer's son, and when I think of, you know, the black soil or whatever the color of the soil is and the grain and so on, but you go down and you're into potash and vehicles drive around in the drifts and so on and so forth. And,
oh, a potash mine in the mining elevation at 3,000 feet down or so, you have pillars that are the original ore as it stood. And between the pillars there are vacant spaces, which is the mine.
Yes, yes. Stopes, do they still call them stopes?
No, not in the potash mines. They're not stopes. They
run adrift, and then dig out the ceiling, letting the stuff fall down, and so on and so forth. Mm. Yeah, one would look at the pillars with a little care because they're holding up.
They're holding up the whole thing.
Everything up there. You've been in a potash
mine? Oh, I've been in several of them. Yes. Yeah.
You enjoyed the work for mining companies, I'm sure, quite aside from the income.
Oh, yes, we did.
Yeah.
We did, indeed.
Did you do any work for mining companies in Northern Ontario, by any chance?
No. Oh, well, I don't know. I've been gone so long.
Right.
They've done quite a bit of mining work around in Northern Ontario, but wondering how.
Might I ask when you did leave V.B. Cook. When did you retire from it?
I was 62.
Okay, so that's 87 then.
I have an opinion. I retired myself. In other words, I kicked myself out. Because I don't think that people of a certain age contribute what they should. I don't think in engineering, being 62 years old is an addition to your ability. I don't believe that.
Younger people should do the work.
I think your productive years start easing off after you're about 55.
Have you seen exceptions to that? Says someone who's 68.
Yes, I have. As a matter of fact, we did. We hired a retired engineer who went around fixing up the boiler rooms and what have you on various mills, etc. And he was very good.
Yeah. Would this gentleman still be alive?
Oh, certainly he's
still. I probably know him, right? This wasn't Gordon Stinson by any chance.
Yes.
Yes, I didn't rather thought as much.
Gordon
he did a lot of work in various places, didn't he?
Gordon Stinson joined us for a number of years.
Yeah. I think that your generalization is often true. And if people have...
It can be not true, too.
Yeah, there can be exceptions, but I suspect that the exceptions may well prove the rule. And all of those people who are happy to go to retirement to give up the demands of the job are sort of recognizing that principle. Was it difficult to kick yourself out, or...?
No, because I was so tired. You don't... You realize we had North Central Airways flying out of here then. And most Monday mornings I was on North Central Airways, and at 9 o'clock I'd be at my desk and wherever the hell I was supposed to be.
And you were there all week then?
Yeah.
And then flying back Friday night?
Or 2 weeks or whatever.
Well, that sure as heck is a good way to wear yourself out, all right, and I can understand.
But I was so bushed, I wasn't worth talking to.
I was retired about a year later by the good people of Thunder Bay, and Nipigon as it was at the time, and having led a somewhat similar life in terms of flights to Ottawa and back, I can certainly empathize with that feeling. It's time to recover.
To pull a cork.
Yeah, recover from the rigors that you've lived through. I think what I might do is move. There are some questions here about what might interest or surprise people most about the kind of work that you did in either of the companies in connection with the grain trade, let's say. And if any of these questions leads you, just like, we'll press on to the next one. But is there some activity that might interest or surprise people in what you did?
Oh, I'm sure there is, because most people, of course, think C.D. Howe did it all. He didn't. There were a few of us that were tagging along behind, but nevertheless were affected.
Right. You actually used very strong language about the rivalry, the competition between the two firms.
Well, it was real. Just a minute. Murray Fleming was the president of C.D. Howe Company.
Right.
And Murray Fleming and I became good friends.
Yeah, so I didn't really know him, but I know at St. Paul's United, my church, that Murray Fleming was much respected.
He wasn't in the shyster trade.
No. So he
and I think he made a few mistakes. If he'd done it a little differently, I wouldn't be here. The company wouldn't be here.
Right. That he could have beaten you in the competition.
Oh, certainly, with his hands tied behind his back.
Yeah. But
but fortunately, he didn't.
Right. So that, and certainly the competition with the C.D. Howe Company would interest people because of the political profile that he had.
Yes. And don't forget, a little time after, or during the time, C.D. Howe had 3 contracts to let. And 2 of them he let to Barney McQueen Company. He thought my dad was something special, I guess.
Yeah. Your father was an able manager, able president.
Yes.
Yeah. What are you most proud of in the work that you've done over the years?
I don't know. I think the elevator I was talking to you about, it has some modern concepts in it and what have you. I think that's the one I'm most proud of. And I'll get you the drawings.
When we visit that, and we'll look it over carefully to see if we can figure out what the luck was that smiled upon you in the design that you developed for it. Would you want to say anything about changes that have taken place in the grain trade over the years?
Yes, but I'll be... Yes, because...
That's welcomed here.
The Bunge in Quebec City have a modern operation built in an old elevator, and it's working very well.
Actually, I should have pursued that a bit, because you were describing, or you mentioned the contract, and then we talked about the people
But when he made the tremendous increase in handle, first of all, we had a unload system that was second to none. A train load of grain could pull in on there and keep on going. And when it got to the end of the track, it was empty.
These would be the hopper cars.
They'd be the hopper cars, right. Yes.
So this is what, dropping it?
That the train, like the elevator is here.
Yes.
And the train comes in here and goes around there at very slow speed, of course, and out here. And by that time, a 110 car train is empty.
Right. And so there's a continuous arrangement of grates and so on through which the grain can fall.
That is correct, entirely.
Right.
And there's a little man and a little machine on a sidetrack that can run along and open all the car doors and what have you.
So the first efficiency then is in this unloading capacity that you built in.
Well, I think it's obvious that one of the efficiencies that are generally not practiced too well is unload. Even those that have the surge.
It's static here in Thunder Bay at every elevator, isn't it? The cars are pushed in, they're emptied, and they're pulled back out. I think that's true of all the elevators, is it not? And did you actually design this arrangement that circled the terminal elevator for the unloading then?
That's correct.
Yeah. And could the train continue around the other side then and back on the track and out of town then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the railway company would be pleased too to have it.
Oh, I'm sure the railway company think they're the ideal.
Yeah.
And then we had a ship unloading for self-unloaders only, but it works equally well.
Right. Now this would be for ships that we think of them usually as salty ships that would load here but have the self-unloading capacity and ferry it down, if you, or whatever term one should use, to Quebec City, and then unload the grain there into this terminal.
It makes so much good sense.
Yes, it certainly does. Did this lead adding self-unloaders to their fleets then?
I have no idea.
A question we could ask CSL or whomever, would they?
I have no idea. But it seems so apparent that the first thing you got to do is get the stuff into a place where it can be handled.
Yes. And then the inside, this is where, as you were suggesting a few minutes ago, the real fun would come. You had the structure, the building was there. You removed everything inside it, I take it then, and replaced it all with new equipment then.
Well, generally speaking, we replaced a lot of equipment.
Was it concrete silo construction?
Mm-hmm.
Because you wouldn't remove that, of course.
No.
The storage is kind of standard, I guess, in that sense. But moving grain in and out and the speed with which things could be moved. State-of-the-art dust control, I suppose.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly, as you were saying, too, when you're...
Million tons. That's a lot of grain.
More
than the... Than the port of Thunder Bay puts out in.
Well, I was going to say it's Thunder Bay is pleased to move 30 million tons in a season, isn't it?
Yeah.
And often has moved less than that these years, so it could handle three times what Thunder Bay. Yeah. Has it justified itself in those terms?
Certainly, it has.
Now, are they moving American grain through there as well?
Oh, certainly.
Okay.
They don't care where the grain came from.
No, well, and it's a big American company, so... I've had some contact with someone who is interested in the grain trade in Buffalo. In fact, I have a thesis of his lying there and had it for a long time, and this spring is the time when I'm going to read it finally, because I'm hoping to see Mr. Dowd when I get to New York State in June and tour things there. You haven't done anything in Buffalo. Well, of course, you'd be working in Canada.
No.
I wonder if Bungie has anything in Buffalo.
I have.
Luther Superior.